You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert, and Lucas Townsend and I represent the buyer in this appeal that involves corporate purchase. Because I perceive that the briefs have set forth most of the issues fairly well, and because I know that you wish to focus on the best and narrowest grounds, I propose to focus expressly on the narrowest ground on which you can decide this case, regardless of what you think about the other assignments. That's based upon your holding in SunTrust versus Farrar, where you wrote that damages cannot be recovered if derived from uncertainties, contingencies, or speculation. JB&A had two damage theories when it pleaded the case. First was what we've called in the brief the earnout theory, that but for what happened in this case, the business would have reached the targets that would have triggered our obligation to pay them additional money in the amount of $19 million. The lawyer sensibly and understandably put that theory to the side, and using his phrase during the trial, unsurprisingly because his expert had testified that that's a speculative approach. The trial judge agreed that that would be too speculative, and she disregarded that in analyzing the damages aspect of the case. There was only one theory still standing at the end of the case, and that was their theory that they would have retained their business and sold it to another buyer. But there was no other buyer at that price. That price, by the way, the judge selected was $54 million. She valued the property, the business, at that number. That was based upon an unsupported projection that even she regarded as being too speculative to support damages. You recall that by early 2011, JB&A had completed a month-long exhaustive marketing process. That's what their consultant described it as, an exhaustive process. They tried to sell the business to 61 different potential buyers. 18 of those decided to sniff around and take a look at what JB&A's business looked like. There were several meetings involving management among potential buyers. In the end, all 18 of those said, no thank you, not interested. All except us. We're the only bidder. And JB&A recognized that when, after having received our letter of intent in January of 2011 and having received the analysis of the entire process from its consultant, it said, MCR's bid of $42.7 million in cash is pretty good. You want to take it. And so they signed a letter of intent. One of the issues that JB&A has chided us for is the suggestion that because that letter of intent contained an exclusivity provision preventing them from marketing the property to somebody else while we were hammering out a contract, that suppressed the demand for their business.
But was there any evidence at trial saying, had there not been that, they could have gone out and sold it for $54 million?
There was no evidence whatsoever about that.
Why did they have to go out and sell it anyway? Why couldn't they just say, we could have kept it? We had a $54 million business. You paid us $42 million, and we want the difference.
Because they weren't able to say that they had a $54 million business. Their internal valuation was $37.6 million.
Yeah, but there's plenty of evidence in the record to indicate your clients bought it for $54 million.
Actually, there's no evidence in the record to indicate that. We bought it for $42.7 million with a contingency that would have taken it not to 54, but to 65.
Well, remember, you have a valuation in the record that says that that $65 million had a net present value of $54 million because of the probability of whether or not the marks would be met. So that's how the valuation was figured.
The way that the purchase price allocation got to that figure was to take the total amount of earnout payments and multiply it by a probability factor of roughly 60%. That comes up to about $12 million. When you add 12 onto the $42 million we paid, that's the $54 million figure.
I knew all of that.
Okay.
That's why I was asking.
Okay. What I can tell you is that the trial judge found the initial figures of $19 million to be hopelessly speculative, and there's no cross error to that finding. Speculative numbers don't become less speculative because you multiply them by 60%. Remember, it's a discrete set of numbers. If you reach a certain target, you get a certain amount of money. There was no evidence in the case that the business was actually worth, on the day of sale, $54 million. That was an allocation, an accounting method that the MCR used because they had to satisfy generally accepted accounting.
Can I interrupt you there? So the focus you have is the allocation figure, 54.6, was expressly rejected as a valuation figure. It was more of an accounting estimation.
Correct.
The trial court made a factual finding on that point. No one's arguing to the contrary, but yet that was the predicate for running the damage formula. that ultimately was used.
That's exactly what she did use in calculating the damages. She said that the business was worth $54 million because you said it was.
Where in the record did the court make that finding? You said that this was a speculative number.
At page 2352 of the appendix, where she said that that was too speculative, that it was a matter of merely projecting a hopeful outcome. That's what she specifically said.
That was about the $19 million.
Correct. And then, but there's, again, remember, this is a discrete set of numbers. It's not a sliding scale. You get more money gradually.
I know that. But the fact that the $19 million was speculative was the reason why there was a probability that it was multiplied by to get its net present value.
And this,
because it's speculative doesn't mean it couldn't be valued.
But your holding in Farrar seems to indicate quite the contrary. It's a contingency. You assume that the number will come out somewhere in this fact, and you assume that there is a 60% probability, and so therefore you assume that for accounting purposes, that's the value of the company. But in a court of law, it's different. You have to prove what the actual damages are, and you can't use contingencies. That was the heart of your holding in Farrar.
So if 19 is speculative, 60% of 19 is a fortiori speculative.
I think so, because it's based upon another assumption that there's a 60% probability.
Because something is speculative doesn't mean it doesn't have value. I think that's where we're getting confused here, because quite honestly, you could say a lottery ticket is speculative, whether or not I'm going to win the lottery, but you can create a net present value for a ticket now.
I understand that, and if you assume that ticket is going to win the lottery, then it's worth a lot more than it's...
No. The probability takes care of whether you're going to win it or not in order to reach the net present value.
I understand that. What they had to do, however, was, and there are two aspects of this. One is to prove that it had a value in excess of that. The second, based upon their express claim of damage, their theory of damage, was that they would have retained the business and sold it to another buyer. They specifically pleaded that in this court on page 26 of their brief. So in that case, they couldn't just point to us and say, aha, you are the buyer because you bid more than $42 million. We didn't, by the way. The rest was a contingency. But their theory required that there be a second buyer to come along that would have bailed them out, that would have bid more than that. And that's expressly the theory of damages that they pressed at trial. It's the only basis upon which they could actually claim they would have been better off. They have to prove two aspects of this. The fact of damage, and that's the business was worth more than this, and the amount of damage, that there would have been a bidder who would have paid more than $42 million. Their own assessment was 37. They only got an oral estimate of value of 30 to 35. There was no knight in shining armor to come and bail them out.
May I interrupt again?
Of course.
I'm confused as to how these models work under the legal theories. Rescission and restitution would be, I think, the best model to explain their damage claim. But they weren't seeking rescission and restitution. They were seeking benefit of the bargain, affirm its damages, not disaffirm its damages. So why wouldn't, help me out with this, all of you, why wouldn't the only proper damage model conceptually be benefit of the bargain, I should have gotten all of my loss earn-out money, every dollar of it, and that's what I'm required to ask for, and that's what I'm entitled to.
I think they were required to prove that, and when the judge found that measure to be speculative, that should have been the end of the case.
Right, so how do we go from that to basically a rescission restitution model when there's no rescission or restitution?
Well, there was nothing pleaded. They never asked to rescind or even to remake the benefit.
But where am I mistaking the argument? Isn't the theory that, look, if I'd have known about this truth, I would have kept the business and sold it to someone else. Well, that's a rescission restitution theory.
Yes.
I would have bailed on the contract. I don't want the loss payout, dot bonus numbers. I just would walk. I want all my stuff back, and I'm going to sell it to someone else. And if I had, I would have sold it a lot more value.
Right.
I just don't see how it fits under the damage model to the theory.
It doesn't, because they would have to show that there would be a value they would have realized. Somebody would have paid not more than 36, which they valued it at. 37, I'm sorry, but more than the 42 that we actually paid them. And the rest of it is based upon express contingencies and express assumptions. May I have leave to respond in the time remaining to me? Thank you.
Has he answered your question, Justice Kelly?
No, he didn't, but I can take care of it when you come back.
Yes, may it please the court. David Barger and Michael Scalera on behalf of JB&A. We were trial counsel below. JB&A consists of approximately 200 retirees whose retirement funds are at stake in this case. I'd like to start with what I believe to be the most important issue to our retiree clients, which is the damage award of $12 million plus $3.7 million in prejudgment interest that MCR does not even appeal. I also believe it is the simplest issue, and obviously the one from the questions that were asked, that I think is the most important not only to me and my clients, but perhaps to the court as well. And I hopefully will try to address each of the questions that have been asked here to show why the damage award is appropriate and the judgment should be affirmed. They have a huge burden here. They have to show no evidence of our damage award that would justify the damage award, as opposed to clear error, no evidence. I submit there's a mountain of evidence to show that the contract damages that the court awarded here were entirely appropriate. And this goes back, Justice Kelsey, to the question you were asking. MCR does not contest they breached the contract. They admit. They do not contest that they made false representations on which we relied and we sold the company. Humpty Dumpty was broken. We couldn't get rescission. So there's an aspect on the fraud claim, his argument that, well, we would have sold it to another buyer. That's the theory about valuation having to do with the fraud claim. But on the contract claim, it is simply benefit of the bargain expectancy damages. We sold it to you for $42.5 million in cash. We had the possibility of earning up to $19.5 million on certain goals that we would hit. And MCR itself said, we MCR value what we bought, what we think it's worth, at roughly $54.7 million. That was their benefit of the bargain. They got something they thought was worth $54.7 million, paid us $42.5 million. Under the breach of contract damages count, that they do not contest. All we have to prove is that we prove damages. It's overwhelming. They admitted it. And this goes back to the Farrar point. Unlike Farrar, MCR admits, they ratify the number that was calculated by the McLean Group and approved by the Aronson Group. MCR's own internal experts, their CFO and their CEO, Mr. Kiernan, who used to be a damages expert, they sign off on the financial statements that they use for reporting purposes to say, when we bought this company under our contract, we think that we're going to have to pay $54.7 million. Now, let me back up just a second and give you an example of why even that damage calculation was conservative. When Mr. Emmert says that the judge found that it was a hoped-for outcome, I respectfully disagree. What he's citing to, my recollection of the record, the judge, don't forget, MCR brought a counterclaim and claimed that they were defrauded. The court found that was a totally meritless counterclaim. Their witnesses testified they didn't rely upon our calculations. When the judge said that was a hoped-for outcome, she was talking about our JB&A's projections upon which MCR said they didn't rely. The judge did not make a finding that the purchase price allocation or the $54.7 million was speculative. Quite the contrary. What she was talking about, not only on the SIM, was that downstream, after I'm suspended, we're not going to ever know for sure what government contracts I could have gotten and how much earnout I actually could have gotten. That was the part she was talking about that was a little too speculative, so that she would rather rely upon the calculations for damages at the time of breach, black letter law at the time of the breach, May 31st, 2011. What is the reasonable certainty of my damages? MCR says it's going to be $54.7 million. And I said I was going to back up, and I didn't go there yet. MCR gave revenue calculations, gave probability calculations to the McLean Group, MCR's own data. Respectfully, MCR says in his brief that was from JB&A. That's not true. Appendix 850, Marsha O'Brien, the 17-year CFO, admitted that was MCR's data. Defendant's Exhibit 297, which is the purchase price allocation, there's a dozen times when they say this data came from MCR. MCR, based on their due diligence of the revenue projections and the probabilities, said that they, MCR, believe there was a 95% chance that JB&A would have hit the earnout for 2011 and 2012. You add those together, and it's in Exhibit DX-297. I think the joint appendix is 2068. You add those together, it's $12.5 million. McLean Group then discounted that $12.5 million by 19% to get to the $12 million. So when they talk about $19 million is speculative, but multiply that by 60%, that's not what was done. So there was a 95% probability, according to MCR, we'd get $12.5 million. The court said, well, 12 is a little bit more conservative, I'll do that. At the time of closing, in May of 2011, MCR, trial exhibit, I think it's 152, I could be off on the number. MCR booked at the time of the close of the transaction that MCR thought it would have a liability of $17.5 million to pay in addition to the $42.5. The judge could have relied upon that figure, JBA's own, or MCR's own admission that at the time, this is what we booked because we think we're going to have to owe. Remember, the purchase price allocation calculations were done about 9 months later, but having to look back in time and say, what did we think at the time was going to be the value? But at the time they actually did it, they admitted $17.5 million, which was corroborated by JB&A's founder, Mr. Benvenuto, who testified that it was his opinion that it was a $60 million company, one times annual revenue.
May I interrupt?
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize. I know I'm going really fast.
That's all right.
There's so many facts, and I apologize.
But to focus the point, if the 54.6 allocation is not intrinsically speculative, which is the argument being made, then your model relies upon a non-speculative base to run its calculation. Isn't that really the end of the analysis?
If I understand your question, the answer is yes.
Yeah, I mean, he takes the axe to the root, and the root is the allocation 54.6 is intrinsically unreliable because it's not meant to be a valuation model truly, and it was disclaimed, and the trial court made a factual finding that it was, in fact, speculative, inherently speculative. But if that's not the correct, if a reasonable fact finder could find that predicate number to be reasonably reliable, then the model falls into place.
Absolutely. That's why I don't mean to be, I try not to be too repetitive, but that's why I came back to, not only is this the most important issue to our clients for the obvious reason of that's where all the damages are, because we don't get to double count, right, on the fraud count. The fraud count really goes to the side, except for fees. It is the simplest. It is the evidence is overwhelming, and unlike Farrar, we have the actual buyer.
Okay, before you run out of time, can you transition now to the second part of the argument? The second part of the argument is, okay, I don't think the number is right. I don't think it's anything other than speculative. But even if it weren't speculative, they have to have some showing that they could have sold it to someone for that. They may think it was worth that, but that's not showing evidence of value until you can say a willing buyer would buy it for that.
I respectfully disagree. That analysis of their claim that, oh, you have to find another buyer, that argument goes to, on the fraud count, we wouldn't have sold to you had we known. We'd have waited and seen. And so the notion of I have to find a buyer other than MCR at best goes to the fraud count damages. If you award the damages under the contract claim, which are the same amount, it doesn't matter.
Well, assume but hypothetically the fraud count fails under contort analysis, and we're only looking at a pure contractual theory.
I apologize. I didn't hear the first part.
Assume for the sake of analysis we're just looking at a pure contractual damage theory, not a fraud recovery theory.
Then I don't think we need to waste our time on whether there was sufficient evidence of value on the fraud claim. I do believe, I submit...
Can I stop you just because I think you guys are passing the night here?
I apologize.
Just to make it quicker. That's okay. In essence, you're saying that the whole argument concerning them finding another buyer was part of measuring the rescission damages, and you aren't claiming that. You're claiming a contract damage.
I don't want to give up the fraud damages only because I think it's relevant to fees, but they're unnecessary. And you're exactly right. That argument applies.
And I think that's what Justice Kelsey was asking you.
Yes. The easiest one is to look at the breach of contract where they themselves said, this is what we think it's worth to us. We admit it. We ratify it. We adopt it. That's just benefit of the bargain damages. You got something from me you think is worth X. You only paid me Y. I get the delta. And you're telling us that all of that evidence is purely speculative and meaningless? You didn't think it was speculative. You have to use it for tax returns. You have to do it for financial statements. You use it with your investors. I mean, it's. I hearken back to the first case I heard when I was sitting here where U-Haul said they take responsibility for what they did. MCR refuses to take responsibility for any of this. Their argument is we get zero damages. And respectfully, that's just absurd on this record. Their own documents, their own contemporaneous documents, their witnesses at trial said this was an arm's length transaction between a willing seller and a willing buyer. The 17-year CFO, Marsha O'Brien, says that's what the $54 million represents. An arm's length transaction between us and them. That's contract damages.
I mean, what part of what makes this difficult, for me anyway, is that there's two components. One is what we're paying now up front, and the second component is what we're projecting forward we're going to earn.
Yes.
And so clearly on the 42.7, if my memory is right, that's locked down. And the question is, is this with a future earnings, did the market just tank? Is that the problem? Or is it because they got in trouble with the federal government and that led to flight of clients and drying up of business? And so it's just very difficult to try to figure out why those additional payments didn't come in. That's what makes this case a little mind-bending on the damages side for me.
And you're correct. And so if we hadn't tried to measure downstream at the end of 2011 and then again at the end of 2012, don't forget the business is blown up by then. I mean, we've lost 100 of the 200 employees. Look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 246A. It's a November letter by MCR to the Air Force after they've been suspended twice, when they say, if you don't let us off suspension, you're killing us, and you're specifically killing JB&A. And you know whose money's at stake? They put it in the letter. They've got retirement income that is in jeopardy, and the business may fail and may close. Plaintiff's Exhibit 82, I apologize, I don't remember the joint appendix sites, but it's in the index. Same thing, MCR are making projections about how devastating, and they use the words catastrophic. You know, so you're right, downstream, by its nature, it's a predictive model. You know, where we are, you know, in May, we'll never know exactly whether we would have hit those targets because it's government contracting, and it's in the record. The notion of getting the government to come in and go, well, I would have given you an additional contract had I known you're not suspended. We put some evidence in on that. But because damages are measured most effectively at the time of the breach, you know, we looked at what's the evidence of what it was worth back then. There's corroboration downstream, but we didn't have to use that model. You know, so and the court correctly said, you know, let's put it to the side, and we were fine with that because, frankly, the better evidence, the easier evidence to wrap your mind around, was we know what they said it was worth back then, right? And they were begging that if you don't let me out, it's going to be catastrophic, and that's helpful. But we'll never know for sure just how many contracts we would have gotten, and frankly, that's why we're not being greedy.
But you do have evidence in the record concerning the fact that, you know, certain partnering agreements could not be entered because of the suspension.
Yes.
And various renewals couldn't happen because of the
suspension,
et cetera, and the effect that it had on the business, which was detrimental.
Yes. I don't remember the exact numbers. We had to hit $61.5 million at the end of 2011 to get our first earnout, which was 4-point-something million. 2012, we had to hit, I think, $65 million to get another $7 million. I think even with the two suspensions, JB&A had about $57 million, and MCR admitted, look, we know there are these contracts that weren't renewed, so we'll give you that. So it was like $59.9 million that they concede we would have gotten, and the argument was, yeah, but that's not 61.5, you didn't get close enough. We'll never know. We can't get the government to come in here and say, yeah, you know, we would have given you this contract. And so I concede there is that component of unpredictability there, which is why we embraced, okay, measured damages at the time of the breach. These are, I know I'm repetitive, it's their own admissions. They themselves said, this is what we think it's worth. Mr. Emmert's right, it's a contingent liability, which is why if it wasn't, maybe we wouldn't be here, right? They'd have had to, you know, but that's what makes this a little bit of an unusual model. You know, can we show with reasonable
certainty?
In your time
remaining, can you focus on the attorney's fees question?
Well, from an evidentiary
standpoint, you don't have attorney's fees under the breach of contract, correct?
Correct.
So the trial judge says you have this amount of damages, and I find the damages are identical for both of these causes of action.
Correct. Sorry, you know that. I don't mean, I'm sorry when I say correct, it's just me. Sorry.
Sorry. I like being correct.
Correct as usual.
Especially at home, I like being correct.
How do you get the source of the duty question distinct from the contract theory in order to get attorney's fees on the fraud theory?
I don't know if there's enough time to answer the
question. Yeah, no, you can answer the question.
You're talking to the man. You got as much time as he
does. Yes, sir. He's running the clock. Yes, sir. Well, thank you for that opportunity. From my perspective, the source of duty topic is an easy one because this court has said for, I don't know, 50 years, you can get a fraud in the inducement either to sign the contract or to perform the contract. Sometimes it usually comes up in closing the contract, which is what we have here, in order to induce me to close the contract. You said something, and in this situation, it's an intervening fact that you know is important. You know, MCR admitted, they're on cross-examination, I asked four or five of their people, if you had been JB&A and MCR had done this to you, would you have wanted to know that before you decided to close? And they're like, yeah.
But the bring-down warranty is just a contractual warranty. It's not a tort. There's no tort duty that required them to do anything. Every bit of the original warranty and the bring-down warranty at closing arose from the contractual relationship.
I respectfully disagree.
Okay, why?
Because the bring-down, I'll use this phrase, I think, to be most succinct about it. There was no duty by MCR to give us a bring-down certificate they knew was false. It would be absurd to say I had a contractual duty to give you a bring-down certificate that I knew was false, yet they knew it was false. And so the contractual duty is if I want to close the transaction, I have to give you a bring-down certificate saying there have been no material changes. And the consequence to not doing that under this contract for MCR was if I choose not to give you the certificate, if I choose not to close, we didn't have a contractual remedy. Everybody gets to walk away. That's why this is a little bit unusual in the terms that it raises both breach of contract and tort liability, which Horner, Devine, all those cases recognize black letter law. It's the facts. The same facts can just.
Fair enough. You've answered the question.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
And I don't know that I don't know that I fully addressed your question, but I know I'm out of time. So can I keep going?
No. Thank you. Rebuttal.
The no threw me off. And that's why I never drink water, but I drank water. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's quite right.
Thank you very much.
I think we know your position from your briefs.
Mr. Barger misspoke a few moments ago when he said that the theory about needing an additional buyer only related to the tort claim. That's incorrect. Their approach for damages and liability was the same under both of these theories at the trial. What's more, the suggestion, and I want to address Mr. Justice Goodwin's question about why isn't this projection satisfactory evidence, is because of the separate holding that you had in Farrar, which is that the proponent of a valuation must show that there was a market for the property at that price.
Yeah, but they've shown the market because you bought it for that price.
You are
the market.
We bought it for $42.7 million plus contingencies.
Exactly, and contingencies have net present value.
But the
net present value of that contingency was over $12 million. To me, it's not a hard thing. I know you were an economics major, too. I mean, so I know you can crunch the numbers.
I certainly understand about projections. But this court held in Farrar that you can't use an assumption or a projection or a contingency to value something for property like that.
Well, you can as long as it's not inherently speculative, as long as no rational person could make that projection, because economics and valuation is full of guesswork, so to speak.
True. The law requires a little more certainty than just guesswork, though. You've always condemned valuations that were based upon assumptions and speculation and guesswork. Farrar is only one in a long string of these cases that did.
Right, but it doesn't prevent someone coming up with a net present value for something that's going to happen in the future or a payment that's going to be made in the future and paying that amount for it.
Correct. And even we didn't agree to pay $54 million. That's why they have two failures. One is the failure to show that anybody would have paid more. And the second is to show how much they would have paid. That's the damages component. That's assignment 3, which is why it's separate from 2. What I want to mention is here is that JB&A realized that they were in trouble before the closing. You'll see that in three places in the record. One is at page 1906. Another is at page 1986 of the appendix, which are internal email trails among JB&A thinking that express internally, we're in trouble. We're not going to hit these projections this year. You'll also find them in Defendant's Exhibit 282, which I regret is not in the appendix, but it's in the record, which is another series of internal communications where they recognize we have troubles that are entirely unrelated to anything that happened to MCR that were causing them to lose business. And so they didn't believe that they were going to hit the projections. We didn't believe that they were going to hit the projections. And the trial court didn't believe that they were going to hit the projections. That makes it entirely speculative. No matter what percentage you assume is the likelihood of achieving it, it's still speculative. It's still based on contingencies. They also claim that the purchase price allocation is an admission. This may be part of what you're relying upon, Your Honor, in this, that it's an admission on our part that the property is worth this value.
If you didn't believe those numbers, why were they in your accounting document?
Accountants have to have some number for something in an allocation. We eventually wrote it down to zero when we realized that the numbers were never going to come close to the purchase price, excuse me, to the earnout figures. But this is the same factor as what happened in Farrar. And you ruled that the fact that the trustee had himself commissioned it was not an admission because there was no evidence of a willing buyer at that price. It wasn't an admission in Farrar, and it's not an admission for us.
Can you briefly address whether or not the bring down warranty violation is a tort-based duty violation or a contract-based duty violation?
It has to be a contract. And for that, I'll go back to the Sensenbrenner definition. Tort law addresses the safety of persons and property, as you phrased it in that decision. There are no persons whose safety is at risk here. There's no property that's at risk here.
Am I misunderstanding your opponent's position if I interpret it to mean that every breach of contract would be a tort remedy if it's a breach of contract that includes a innocent constructive fraud or a intentional actual fraud misrepresentation?
As long as the origin of the duty is in contract, is in a document signed by the parties, that's exactly right. They would seek to turn every breach of contract into a tort because you could always sue saying, you had a duty to provide me a good one, not a bad one.
But isn't there a distinction here? I mean, isn't this kind of like our, Ware case, where you've got the instance where someone's not under contractual duty to do something, but you are under a contractual duty to let a person know that a fact has changed if they have an executory contract that they're not going to have to enter if you tell them the truth.
Where wasn't a circumstance where the fact changed later. That was a previous matter, and you held that that was a matter where the parties had a mutual mistake of fact.
Right, and in this particular instance, especially if we consider this to be constructive fraud, when they made the APA agreement, there was no investigation, and they did not know there was one. But by the time of the closing, they knew there was an investigation. So there was a change in fact, and there could have been a mutual mistake as to whether or not there was an investigation going on.
They had a duty in the bring-down certificate to bring down, to renew the warranties that were made in the original contract. But you've held, specifically very recently, no Virginia case either in the No Virginia case, either in the context of fraudulent inducement or otherwise, has imposed a tort duty under these circumstances of subsequent change of fact. It's a contractual duty.
Right, but I guess my thing is, even if there was not a bring-down certificate, wouldn't there have been a duty on the part of your client to let them know of this change in circumstance concerning the fact that there was an ongoing investigation before this closing happened?
If there was such a duty, it arose in the contract. Because the contract, once they enter into it, defines the party's duties.
You've the contract doesn't say anything about updating you later about things that you told me before were true.
But that's the purpose of the bring-down certificate, is renewing the warranties that were made. We warranted certain things as of early May of 2011. And the requirement that we had imposed by the contract upon us was to make those make those warranties good as of May 31st, the closing date. We didn't have a duty in tort law to do that. The duty was in contract to provide that certificate. If they have any claim here, it's for breach of that warranty. I wish I did have more time to go on because this is fascinating.
I have one question, Mr. Chief Justice. Would you address his argument that Devine versus Buki informs the attorney's fees decision?
define, there was, let me check my notes for just a moment because I want to make sure I get you the right answer.
Real estate transaction.
I'm sorry, I understand. I knew the case. I just want to make sure I had the right response to it. In this court more recently in December 2015 in the Modern Oil case explained why Devine doesn't apply. This was another situation where the change was made after the promise was the change happened after the promise was made. That becomes a breach of that subsequent promise, but it's not an independent tort. Devine versus Bucci is a separate issue. And by the way, it also involved the safety of persons and property, unlike this. That was specifically a matter where the foundation of the house was unstable. Property itself was at risk, and persons inside would be at risk. Those are two different qualifications. Why? I appreciate
your
courtesy to me today.
Call the next case.